it's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 382 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so very much for listening. This week, I have a special interview with Bill Williams, the writer for Punchline from Antarctic Press. I really love this book, and you'll hear me talk about it a lot during our interview, but it's a great character-driven drama with two female leads, basically, and how they grow to work together is a real fascinating experience. The first trade is out now, and issue number 6 is available as well. So I highly encourage you to check with your local store and get it put on your pull list, something I'll say again during the interview. We find out a little bit about what's in the future for Punchline, as well as other projects that Bill has going. So be sure to listen, because he's got a lot of interesting things to say about the industry, as well as the books themselves. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to talk with Bill Williams, one of the driving forces behind a series called Punchline that I really like. I got the chance to read it. You made them available to me, Bill, and I really liked them. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. It's just a pleasure to talk with you because I like the book. And I'm going to tell you, there's several things about it that really stood out to me. But why don't you, before we get started on it, talk about what is Punchline about?
This is going to be easy to do because I did a couple of big signings in Austin over Free Comic Book Day. Mm-hmm. So I have made my pitch about 500 times recently. Punchline is the story of a superhero who gets fired and has to train her replacement. Mm. That's the first big story arc. After that, we introduce a bunch of wacky new characters, and depending on who sticks, we're going to keep going.
So this is the beginning of you're creating a new universe with this?
We sort of are. I don't like to think in those terms. I like to think that we're making good comics. They may end up being something, but there is, you know, subtle world building stuff going on, you know, not on every page, but as the story goes along.
Well, I have to tell you, I love people who can world build because I hate to tell you, but in my opinion, if you can write a character in New York City, all you got to do is visit New York once and you'll know what New York City is about. But yes, when you're building a new world like what you're doing, I just admire that. I think that is such a great thing. I have to say, I loved the books. Did I say that already? I may say that a couple of times because I really enjoyed it.
It's okay. I can hear it as many times as you want to say it.
So I was talking to an artist and I said, you know, you're probably getting tired of hearing this, but I love your artwork. He said, I never get tired of hearing that.
No. Comic book creators are basically a bunch of shut-ins. Yeah. You know, you don't go on a street corner and make comics for nickels. You know, you're alone in your room listening to death metal or whatever it is that you do, mm-hmm. and you're grinding out pages on your own. I mean, it's nice to get feedback from people.
Mm-hmm. Now, first, I got to ask, of course, why is it called Punchline?
That was Matt Weldon's idea. Matt is my partner in crime on the project, mm-hmm. and Matthew said, you know, we need a name for this thing. When I met him, I ran into him at Dragon's Lair. They used to do an event. The one in Austin used to do an event every year with webcomics people. And at the time, I had a webcomic coming out, and I saw Matt's stuff, and I thought, wow, this guy can draw. Mm-hmm. So I said, let's work on something. So a couple of years later, I run into him, and our schedules fit. I pitched him a couple of projects, and he liked the superhero one. So we've been working on that ever since. But I sat down with an idea more than a name. Mm-hmm. And Matt came up with the name of our lead character, Versima. Mm-hmm. And he came up with the name for the series, which is great because, you know, at one point I threatened to kill one of the characters. And Matt just said, well, you can't do that. And I said, well, it's not called Mel's Adventures. It's not called Versima's Adventures. Mm-hmm. It's called Punchline. So if we want to kick somebody off stage for a while and tell other stories, we can, as long as it's, you know, kind of in that same world.
Now, you have a trade that's out, right? Is it come out yet? Okay, yeah, because it's out. And I noticed you gave me the one after the trades. I went back through the trade and I looked and I went, whoa, I've read more than this trade has. So I'm a little ahead of the game with that. Now, who is publishing Punchline?
It comes out from Antarctic Press, and Antarctic Press just does creator-owned books, and we take care of the digital rights. So, you know, it's me trying to get books through the process over at Comixology, or, you know, putting them up in a big hurry over at Drive-Thru Comics.
Mm-hmm. Is it in Diamond?
It is. It came out through... Basically, Diamond shipped our first trade paperback and Punchline 6. Those both came out last week through Diamond.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, unfortunately, everything except issue 6 is sold out, or not sold out, but as Diamond puts it, they're back ordered at the moment.
Oh, wow. So in other words, it's going well.
Yes.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that, because I there's so much I want to talk about this book. I have a thing, and people listening to this podcast are going to notice this, is that I tend to really enjoy comics with female leads.
Yeah.
I have this thing about that. I have, and on the other hand, I have female friends who think that every female lead must be maternal. They need to sit down and talk about their, that's kind of my response. I sit there and they want them to sit and talk about their problems. They want them to hold hands and discuss things and come to conclusions. And I say, boy, are you ever limiting women characters? Because men don't do that. Men aren't only, you know, aggressive Hawkman type people. There's all different kinds, scientists, things like that. You're really limiting women if you do that, I feel. And your book has two female leads.
Yeah.
In it. And they, neither of them is really maternal that I could see in it. So I really like that about the book. I always kind of think, you know, how different a book would be if you had decided to go with male leads.
Which the thing is, there's tons of books with male leads out there. And I think that you can have a wider field of reactions and thoughts and feelings working with female characters than you can with male characters. So there's a scene in Punchline 6 where Mel and Jesse are kind of bonding. Mel is the hero that's been fired and Jesse is her replacement. And Mel lets some of her biography slip. And Jesse is touched in that moment. She wants to express that to Mel, and Mel tells her, yeah, we already hugged today. You know, they're not, you know, she's not real huggy. You know, it's freaked her out since the first issue. It's like, you know, I like you, but, you know, I like you at a distance, kind of like you.
Mm-hmm. I like the fact that these are two female characters, and yet they're very different from each other.
Yeah. What I looked at it is I looked at it in terms of a generational thing. Mm-hmm. If we imagine that in Mel's other identity, she's been fighting crime since World War II. Mm. She's very old. She's a greatest generation type, kept alive by her superpowers. Mm-hmm. And she has to train a millennial replacement, which is where the friction comes from, because Mel is very much from the school of, well, if you don't put a bullet in the villain's head, everything he does from there on out, that's kind of on you. Mm-hmm. And Jesse's much more modern, and her opinion is that you shouldn't kill people. And she hasn't articulated why she thinks that, but she thinks that because if you kill someone, you take away the chance that they're going to redeem themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, so as long as you're alive, you've got a chance to fix what's wrong with your life. Mm-hmm. And Mel's from the school of just, yeah, that's a terrible guy. I'm just pulling the trigger. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the core conflicts between the two leads.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, right from the beginning, I mean, the book starts out with them interacting.
Yeah.
Beginning. And I don't want to spoil too much. I don't know how much you want to give away on this stuff, but let's just say they interact. The question I always have was that set up that they end up both sitting on a park bench in the middle of a winter's night?
Yeah.
And they start talking to each other. And I always wonder, did Mel set that up, you know, to meet Jesse at that point, or was that just purely chance?
It's not purely chance, because the stakes are a little too high in that case. Mm-hmm. But it was set up for them, and that's one of the things that we unearth as the series goes on.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jesse, of course, being a millennial, is her view of what to do is different, as you've been saying, than Mel feels.
Yeah.
It's funny because she has a lot to learn, and of course, Mel's always telling her she has a lot to learn.
Yeah.
And I always get a kick about that because, you know, again, if this was two guys, it'd be a very different story, you know.
the first time that the old timer kind of condescended to the youngster like that, mm-hmm. the youngster just haul off and pop him. As in, yeah, that's how much I got to learn.
Yeah.
You know, but with some women in the way that they behave and act, they're a little more strategic than that. So they're still kind of feeling each other out to the extent that they're in the middle of a very long fencing match.
Mm-hmm. Which is something. Now, does Jesse know that she's about to, shall we say, join the superhero league of stuff? Does she know that when she gets there?
I don't think so. Yeah,
I didn't get that impression from
Jesse
her.
Jesse's dealing with a lot of family drama that mm-hmm. comes from the relatively recent death of her brother. So she's kind of just getting out of the house and she's sitting in a very quiet place, and some wounded kind of jackass woman kind of, you know, barges into her life, and they go on from there.
Because the dialogue is that she's sitting on the thing, on the seat, and Jesse stands up, and then Mel says, "Now hold out your hand. I need to cut you to the bone."
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, Jesse, like a good sane person, says, "Are you insane?"
Yes.
And then, of course, that discussion goes on from there. But one of the things, it's a real strength of this book, is the dialogue, I have to say.
Thanks.
As guys, sometimes we struggle with women and what they want and what they want to say and what they want to hear. I don't get the sense that you have that struggle so much, because both of these women have very strong characters, very interesting. And when they speak, I can almost hear their voices.
Yeah. Well, they're very different. And part of my problem is I've struggled to give Jesse a decent sense of humor. Mel, you know, it's easy to be kind of a conversational sniper where you're just throwing in shitty little comments from time to time. And that's kind of Mel's style, you know, in the first issue when Jesse says, you know, "Wow, I can fly. How do you know?" And Mel says, "Well, it's because I can't anymore. So fly around and stop a crime. Don't make me push you off this building." I mean, she's angry. Mm-hmm. So she's, you know, trying to reconcile her new place in the world, which is, you know, not her choice. Like I said, I just did a couple of big signings for a free comic book day, and I think I signed maybe 500 copies of the book.
Wow.
And well, it was all an all day thing, 3 hours here, 4 hours there. So it was, wow. I got my chance at a lot of pitches to people. Mm-hmm. And whenever I say it's about a hero that's been fired who has to train her replacement, there's a lot of head shaking. There's a lot of nodding. You know, I've spent a lot of time writing screenplays. And one of the things that's kind of beaten into your head about screenwriting is to have a relatable experience with the characters, you know, so that you can identify with it. You know, I've been fired. Well, you know, how would I pass on, you know, this stupid amount of power to somebody else? You know, what would that look like? So,
well, one of the great sequences at the beginning is when they go through costumes.
Yeah.
There's this wonderful bit where she basically snaps her finger a la Thanos, and of course you didn't know that when you were doing it, but she snaps her finger and then the costumes change. And the wonderful thing about Jessie is, and the way that Matthew's drawing her, she's always wide-eyed.
Yes.
Eyes are like saucers, ooh, you know, like, oh no.
Yeah. Kinda.
And I get a huge kick out of that when she's doing that, she's snapping her fingers and she turns into different things. And I won't spoil it for her, because the part of the humor in it is to see what happens and which ones she gets. And
yeah.
I had to laugh out loud when I saw that. I thought that was wonderfully funny stuff.
Matthew Weldon is a very funny guy. Whenever I'm looking through the pages at the pencil stage and then sometimes at the ink stage, there's something in there that just invariably makes me laugh. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just looked at he is also penciling a book with a buddy of ours, and it's a funny animal book. Mm-hmm. And there's he's working with Tim Lim on the on a Black Ops book. Mm-hmm. And it's a bunny and a turtle and a sloth. And they're out there trying to do some sort of military style mission. And he just has a great range of expressions in his work. He's a smart guy. He draws really well. And, you know, there's a lot of whispering about him, you know, maybe being that breakout artist of his generation. Wow. And, you know, I certainly hope that's the case.
Well, it's really great. I mean, you know, superhero books. And that's another thing I wanted to talk with you about, is the fact that so many people say that superhero books, you can't do them because DC and Marvel have the market on them. You know,
there's
no such thing as a superhero book that's different. And yet you've come up with a very interesting concept that I have not seen before. And I've been reading comics for a long time.
Yeah.
So when I read this book and I started to get into it, it's like when you tell people about the fact that she has to get a replacement. We don't get that in comics very much.
No.
So I love that.
Usually there's a decades-long generational kind of struggle to pick, you know, handpick who the successor is. And, you know, will it be Tim Drake? Will it be Dick Grayson? Will it be, it's kind of all the above. But what I wanted to do with this book was kind of invert a lot of things that happen within the world of comics. So, for example, if you have like Batman and Robin, you know, traditionally Batman was the very experienced, very kind of worldly superhero, and he had this wide-eyed sidekick. Mm-hmm. Well, in our book, we've got a very worldly, experienced, kind of burned out sidekick and a kind of wide eyed innocent as our lead character, as our big costumed hero. So I wanted to try to do some things that I haven't seen before because I've read a bajillion comics, and I'm just trying to, when you start on a project like this, you live with these characters, and I wanted to live with something that was new and different for me.
Mm-hmm. One of the very first missions that that Jessica goes on, she comes across what looks like a van full of criminals.
Yeah.
And, you know, she doesn't necessarily punch, shall we say, but they end up being taken care of in a very creative way. And I don't want to spoil it, but let's just say that what they say is, we're moving to Florida, which made me laugh right out loud.
Yes.
It was such an interesting way. It was something they didn't expect. And they said, we're moving to Florida. They go.
In issue 6, Mel and Jesse argue about bands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, you know, I can't believe you don't know who this band is, but you know who Poison is. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with you? You know, one of the things that I think hurts a lot of fiction is the characters aren't allowed to have a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And it's complicated because there's nothing more unfunny than a bad sense of humor. So, you know, you have to really kind of work this out and figure out where the humor comes from and how people are getting along. I mean, in Punchline, at some point, Mel says, you know, I have a certain amount of experience. And Jesse says, you know, what is that, because you're old? I mean, because you've been doing this for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to give Jesse kind of a not exactly Michael Scott level of sense of humor because she's self-aware at some level. But, you know, her humor kind of comes from her accidentally stepping into stuff, you know, and Mel's is just, you know, terrible barbs she's throwing in from the outside.
Mm-hmm. It's really funny because you remind me of a situation I went through. I was working in an office and there was a girl who was in there and she was like in her early 20s. And she had no concept of age. And then she was going on, she started to interact with this guy who was like in his early 30s, and she said, he's so old. And of course, all of us were 40s plus, and we said,
yes,
how old was he? 30s? Oh my gosh, he needed a cane or something. That we were
Yeah, you can get into trouble when you're honestly expressing what you feel, mm-hmm. and you're coming from a place where you're just not terribly informed. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's where Jesse's comedy comes from time to time.
Mm-hmm, which is good. It's really funny, but you know, as I just look through the pages, I see those bright eyes looking. Almost every page I see great big eyes of Jesse's looking at stuff and being wide-eyed and stuff. It's just
Matthew has a part of his reference is anime and manga. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every once in a while there would be a manga panel in the book where Jesse's having some sort of hilarious reaction shot to something, and I like it and it makes me laugh. But we've had people say, this doesn't belong in a proper superhero comic. I'm all right. Oh, this may not be a proper superhero comic. It's ours, but I don't want to say it's proper.
Now, part of the fun of Jessie's experience is to see her go through situations that she's never experienced before.
Yeah.
And like in one of the issues, she discovers what looks to be like a variation on the Blue Beetle, like the original Blue Beetle, not the current one, but the way back one with red gloves and a blue costume and stuff like
that.
And part of the fun is how these two interact and the misunderstandings they have right away. The Blue Beetle-like character says, what's the name of that character, by the way?
That character's named Beetle Girl.
Beetle Girl, okay, that's what she goes and says, what kind of monster destroys a memorial to fallen police officers? And Jesse goes, wait, it was like this when I got here.
Yeah. The thing about Jesse is at some level, she really wants to get along with everybody. She really wants to be liked. So whenever she comes across kind of a blown up police memorial, and she's misunderstood as the bad guy there. She's like, you know, wait, we don't have to do this, you know. But Beetle Girl, you know, she's kind of got her dander up. She's irritated, and she's going to punch somebody. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the Beetle Girl character I found online, and I really like the character. Mm-hmm. She's based off of the original Blue Beetle, who had a shirt that was light as silk and strong as steel, and he was a cop and he fought crime and stuff. And this character, I believe, is his granddaughter or something like this. But it's very much a Beetle-themed Batgirl type character. Mm-hmm. So when I was trying to explain to Matt what their fight looked like, I explained it's Supergirl and Batgirl fighting, you know, a big goat man on a bridge. And he's like, okay, I can make this work. You know, it's just it's boiling things down to their essentials when you're dealing with an artist.
Now, talk a little bit about Jesse's family and stuff like that. You talk about the drama with that. And, of course, that's a normal thing teenagers always struggle yeah. with is drama, stuff like that. What's the situation with her parents?
Well, this is a plot point in, I think, punchline 4 or 5. Jesse's brother had died of a heroin overdose. Mm. He had been a college athlete and had busted a leg mm-hmm. and was on painkillers. And, you know, they took hold and he OD'd and he's not in the room anymore. Mm. So, you know, that family is kind of fractured along those lines. Mm-hmm. I worked with a guy and he and his kid were going down a slide and her leg got tucked up under him and broke. Mm. And it wasn't anything that he had planned on when they started down that slide. Mm-hmm. But at some level in the back of his mind, he knew that he had accidentally broken his kid's leg. Mm. So, you know, they went and they got her in a cast and, you know, got her taken care of. And, you know, accidents happen. In this case, it's a family trying to reconcile the fact that maybe they did everything right, but they still had somebody in their family die. Mm-hmm. You know, when somebody close to you passes, there's that potential to have the feeling that you didn't do enough.
Right.
And that comes out in the mother's dialogue in part of Punchline 5.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, this is a thing you've made these women characters very human.
Yeah.
That we get to see, you know, Mel struggle to take down bad guys, even though she doesn't have power. She's trying to figure out how to make that happen. And on the other side, you've got Jesse trying to deal with the family struggles and things like that. So each of them, they're not necessarily super heroic all the time. We get to see the human aspects to the character. And I think that's something that's really good. And I think that's one of the strengths of the book is to, we've got superheroic action going on, but we also have these characters dealing with struggles.
And yeah.
It's really, you know, inspiring in many senses to watch these people fight with these things and to come forward. And, you know, one of them will struggle at a time when the other one needs their help.
Yeah.
So we see the two of them help each other with that. And I like that.
Yeah. In Mel's case, one of the reasons that she's been fired is essentially she's kind of an adrenaline junkie at this point. Mm-hmm. And she just really likes going out and beating up bad guys. Mm-hmm. And she can't stop. Even when she loses her powers, she's still got this treasure trove of stuff that she's stolen from bad guys over the years when she's kept a gun here or a magic prosthetic there. So she just can't quit. Mm-hmm. And there'll be some downside for that, I'm sure, at some point. But it's fun to have a cranky sidekick who is sort of useful in a fight.
It's kind of funny because doesn't she refer – Jesse refer to Mel as a sidekick at one point?
Yes. in Punchline 3, she says, I've got the world's crankiest sidekick. And they're on comm units. And, you know, Jesse kind of jerks her head to the side. And she says, you know, and my sidekick's, you know, cursing like a sailor in my ear right now. Matt's doing his best to make sure that I don't use any bad language in the book. And, you know, that's a good idea. So occasionally I have to imply that Mel's being terrible without showing Mel's being terrible.
Well, you know, it's such a great thing that they're human.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not necessarily – well, we know that Mel has lost the powers and she's struggling with being able to do that. But there are times when Jesse, let's just say that she's nigh invulnerable, but she doesn't seem to always be invulnerable. And they take on a bad guy in which she actually gets knocked out.
Yeah.
And we get to see stuff. And Mel actually has to kind of encourage her to get back in the game, as she puts it.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Mel is – Mel's cursed with a pretty good self-awareness. She knows exactly how powerless she is. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the inverse again with Jesse, who has a lot of power and doesn't really tap into it as well as she could. And part of her becoming a better hero is to having more self-confidence and managing to not get sucker punched from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk about bad guys.
Okay.
You know, because you've got one particular bad guys we see. We see them deal with thieves often. But yeah. Then we get to see a really big bad guy as we get towards like issue 4.
Yeah.
And stuff.
There's a shark man named Sawtooth who is basically enforcer for a group of drug dealers. And the characters run across him for a while. And I just liked riding a big shark man. And the thing about sharks is when they attack, their eyes roll back in their head and they follow kind of an electrical impulse and they basically just become an eating machine. So in the case with some of these scenes with Matt, I just tell him, go ahead and choreograph a 5-page fight scene and I'll letter it later. So when it comes time to letter the book, I realize, well, you know, if he is part shark or mostly shark, then he's probably going to do the same thing. So I've got his speech devolving as the fight goes along. You know, early on, he's kind of being funny and having a few laughs, and then they start punching each other and he's just, you know, bite time. Mm-hmm. He's pretty fun with doing that. But the focus being on the two female leads, you need good bad guys. And I think we're still trying to come up with a good bad guy. I had dinner with Ben Dunn. He's one of the two partners at Antarctic Press. And we had a talk and he gave me a scolding for our covers needing to be better and for our stories needing to be better. And he sort of did have a point. We don't have a good big bad guy yet, but I think that there's one in the works. Okay. I brought on a new editor. I take pride from a body of work. I don't argue with people over every comma and underline thing. So I brought on a new editor, a guy named Aaron Sparrow, who edited me on a Richie Rich comic 10 years ago. But he's a really good story guy. And we talked about stuff. And as we were talking, I came up with some pretty good insight into a way to make some pretty memorable villains for the series going forward.
Well, you know, when you're just starting out, though, we need to get to know the characters.
Yeah.
So I didn't notice. I mean, I thought the villain you brought in, Sawtooth, was really good because you challenged Jesse with that. So I didn't. I don't know how much justification there is for that. For me, I liked the book that it was that we got to get to know them before. And of course, that leads to my question that I wanted to be sure and ask, was that as far as superheroes go in this universe that you have here, how long have there been superheroes? You said since World War II? Is this sort of?
I don't know if you read issue 3, mm-hmm. there's a flashback where Mel is a superhero before there was really that kind of word. Mm-hmm. So we would assume that there were people that you could say were characters of legend, probably is a good way to put that. You know, a character like Paul Bunyan or Davy Crockett. These guys are larger than life characters and they would be, you know, at some level superhero-ish. But it's only, I guess, with the advent of the 1900s where you'd have somebody doing something as ridiculous as putting on a costume and wearing a cape and punching somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's good. So there's a history of heroes. These guys aren't, as you mentioned, they've got some history to pull on.
Yeah, and the first thing that Mel wants to do after she's been fired is she wants to go back and take care of her rogues gallery. So they go after a character called Mr. January. Mm-hmm. So that happens in the second issue.
Right, that's a turning point in the relationship. So that's
there's an awesome twist in there. And I've got a buddy who runs a comic shop and he's a fanatical reader for the series now. And he reads it and he says, that awesome twist in issue 2. Why wasn't that in the first issue? I said, well, you know, it didn't occur to me until later, you know, mm-hmm. get off my back, man. I got all kinds of stuff I got to do.
Well, again, you got to introduce the characters to us.
Yeah.
You know, that's what really the whole first trade is introduction for them. You know, we get to see them in new circumstances, them dealing with being new and dealing with each other. That's important. And now that we've established that, now you can move forward and bring in the bad guys, bring in all this.
Yeah, the next trade paperback, the one that collects 6 through 10, it's called Super Frenemies. It is a collection of people that Jesse has a love-hate relationship with. So the first of her people that she deals with is Mel in issue 6, and then there's new characters that come along in 7 through 10.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk about where they are located, because this is not a New York City setup.
Yeah.
Where are they?
I wanted to avoid stuff that we've seen a lot, and I wanted to have something that would sort of work. You know, you can't have, well, I guess you can have, you know, superheroes running all over Pittsburgh or Los Angeles, but I think that there's a reason that Superman and Batman stories work pretty well is because they live in fictional cities where you don't have a lot of prejudice about the city or the town or the state or whatever. So in Austin, where Matthew and I are both based, there's a Seahome power plant, a Seahome this, that, and the other. And I thought, oh, I'm totally going to steal that. That'd make a good name for a city. So Punchline with Mel and Jesse is set in the fictional city of Seahome, which is on the water. So occasionally you get to do fun water stuff.
Does it bear more resemblance to Austin? Or, you know, we talk about world building. Is this a city building? Are you building a new city, or are you kind of taking allusions from realistic cities like Austin?
A little bit here and there. I basically said it was more like Boston than anything else, or, you know, the Boston of our imagination. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that kind of thing. You know, I'm more interested in setting a story in a fictional landscape than a real one, because mm-hmm. while you can photo reference stuff and you can include real world stuff in there, it's just, you know, I don't want to say fiction's more entertaining than reality, because that's obviously not true at some level. But, yeah, I just felt like doing something different.
See, I admire that. I love it when people take us places we haven't been before.
Yeah.
With that. So I really enjoy that about the story, is because I didn't know Seahome, because, you know, supposedly Metropolis is New York and Gotham is Chicago, but they're not really those.
Yeah.
So with Seahome, you have a lot of freedom to do what you want there.
It's more of a blank slate than it would be if you set the city somewhere else. There was a TV show on the air 100 years ago called Houston Nights. Mm-hmm. And it was shot in California, so they had mountains in the background. Mm-hmm. I can tell you pretty much 100% there's not a lot of mountain ranges behind Houston.
No. There was a comic strip in a paper, and it was called Captain Kentucky.
Yeah.
And it was, I don't know if you ever got a chance to see it. It was all, it used, everything was realistic. His cape was the flag of Kentucky. You know, he hated the mayor of the town that he was in. It was Louisville, which is where the paper was printed and stuff like that. And he took great fun in doing terrible things to the mayor. You know, he actually, you just tell you how long ago this was. He put the mayor in charge of, like, the Taliban or whatever it was at that time over. Because he figured that's where he belonged, was someplace like that and stuff. But, you know, that was because that was, you know, sarcastic, and it was, you know, you're having fun with that. What you're doing is you're setting this up so that you could do things and have the story go where it needs to go instead of having to force the setting into the story.
And here's something that happens, part of issue 8, Mel and Jesse are on a rooftop, mm-hmm. like they spend a lot of time on rooftops, and Mel says, okay, today we're going to bug the mayor's office, and Jesse says, I don't know what you're doing today, but I'm not bugging the mayor's office. And Mel says, well, somebody was facilitating that criminal organization within town. We need to make sure it's not our elected representatives. We need to make sure the mayor's not a rat. If that story was set in New York, mm-hmm. then I'd be, you know,
trouble.
I'd have people saying, man, the guy just hates de Blasio. Yeah. You know, it's not what I need. You know, the nice thing about fiction is that you can make stuff up, and it doesn't, while people are going to draw parallels, mm-hmm. there are not obvious parallels. So when you set up a fictional city, what you're doing is you're setting up kind of a system of deniability.
Mm-hmm. Which is great. I love the way it's going. I think it's just great fun. I'm dying to see what you're going to do in the future. And I have to say, if you get the trade, be sure to get number 6, because number 6 is a great move on from number 5, which is the last one in the trade. And I enjoyed that.
The thing that's been interesting about Avengers Endgame, which I still haven't seen. It's been a couple of weeks out now.
Me either.
But the thing about movie tropes being slowly taken over, like it's an alien virus, you know, we've got comic book tropes taking over movie tropes. Mm-hmm. I had never, okay, spoiler for Infinity War, I never thought that you would see a superhero end with everybody dying. Mm-hmm. But in comics, that kind of nonsense happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised that they pulled it off as well as they did. Mm-hmm. But that's the same kind of thing that we're looking at doing. Turning tropes up on their head.
Mm-hmm. Which is great. Now, of course, I've got to ask, as far as their relationships, you know, we've talked about the family, and we've talked about, you know, Mel and her people that she used to be heroes with and stuff like that. Are there other relationships coming that Jesse and Mel will encounter And will that alter their relationship?
A little bit. There's something a little bit off about Mel. Okay. And one of the funny bits of feedback that I get from time to time is I have people telling me, well, I've read all of them and she's still up to something. It's like, well, you know, she acts like that. Mm-hmm. There are characters that they bump into that give you a different view in the way that Mel operates. You know, this is very much early on going to be about Mel and Jesse finding a way to work together. Mm-hmm. And they don't get along for a while. Then they sort of get along. And then they're trying to figure out a way that they can cooperate for the greater good. Mm-hmm. I sent a copy of the book to my buddy. I've been in a writing group with Bill Willingham for a long time. And we've been buddies for a long time. Mm-hmm. And he gave me just this kind of stream of consciousness. And he said, you know, here's what I think about your book. Clip some of that out and put it on the book. But he said, you know, for him, the fun part of the book was figuring out with Jesse whether, in terms of being a hero, Jesse was going to be good or just good enough. Hmm. And that's kind of the struggle between Mel and Jesse, because Mel was technically a hero, but there's a moment in the series where she says, you know, I never said I was a hero. Mm-hmm. I'm more of an avenger. Mm-hmm. You know, she's more of a, I found the bad guy and I'm going to put a knife in his neck, you know, problem solved. And Jesse is a little more proactive. You know, I wanted to represent the generations a little bit differently, where Mel's more about punishing bad guys and Jesse's more about keeping bad people from fulfilling whatever plans they've got in the works.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, interesting. Because I'm just interested as to, this is a series that could go on for quite a long time.
That's the hope.
Yeah, because I'm thinking about, you know, you're talking about world building. We've got this one city where they're located. It would be good to have them go out of that city every once in a while and see what's going on in other parts of this world.
We had talked with the Dynamite guys for a while about doing a crossover with Vampirella, and Matt drew an outstanding piece of artwork. And then the guys at Dynamite realized, oh, we've got a lot of plans in the works because it's Vampirella's 50th anniversary. Let's talk about this again later. So I'm hoping to chat with them out in San Diego this year. But I had written a two-issue vampire, undead, monsters kind of thing. And I realized it wasn't a good Vampirella story, but it was a pretty good story overall. So you see, at one point, the characters go to a place that I've called Mount Valhalla, which is a cemetery for unloved and unwanted superheroes. You know, people that die in combat with no heirs in sight, you know, people that fall through the cracks for some reason. And so that's, of course, where all the public domain characters live. Mm-hmm. So there's a joke about the Black Terror. There's other characters that they meet along the way. But we're building the world. The approach that I'm taking to it is kind of a mix of Stan Lee's first 30 issues of Spider-Man, mm-hmm. and Chris Claremont's first few years on the X-Men, where you throw out a lot of stuff and you see what works and you see what's fun, and then you go back and hit that well a few times.
Mm-hmm. Which is great fun, because, you know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, what if she joins a group of heroes and stuff like that? Because that would be a different thing to see.
Well, being proactive, she decides to kind of build one around her, and it has a kind of a terrible result come out of it. That's our chibi issue.
Oh, boy. Okay. All right. Do you have in mind a number of issues or a number of stories that you want to tell? Or is this kind of still up in the air as far as you're going? Because, like I said, I could see this going on for a while.
I've written scripts through 12. Mm-hmm. I have rough outlines for 13, 14, and 15. Mm-hmm. And I think I know what I would do in the fourth trade paperback. Mm-hmm. I would be blowing a whole lot of spoilers to talk about what would be coming in the fourth trade paperback. I'd be kind of getting out over my skis pretty far. Let's say that the AP guys are pretty happy with the sales as they are.
Good.
And we're going to keep doing this for a while. And that's before any sales bump that comes along, thanks to the free Comic Book Day stuff.
I hope you do, because, you know, this book is really one that I wish I'd known about sooner. I'd have been supporting it.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it.
Because it's such a great book. I love the interaction. I love the humor you mentioned, and it really does shine through. And I love the adventure aspects of it and the relationship. Like
thanks.
I said, the two female characters that this hinges around is really great. And I love those kinds of things. I love exploring those kinds of relationships.
Yeah.
We just don't see that very much, and I just cherish it when it happens.
Well, the superhero genre in the medium is driven by the big companies, because it's easier to sell a new hero book if in month four you can have Batman or Spider-Man guest star.
Right, right.
And in our case, we're out there in just a tidal wave of stuff, because there was a very low barrier to entry to working in the world of comics. I wrote a short film for a buddy of mine and I to go out and shoot, and it's 5 pages long, and it's going to take us a month of planning. And we're going to need to round up actors and get everybody together and do something all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to need to spend some time cutting it. Mm-hmm. Comics are a lot easier to put out. Mm-hmm. And your special effects, they're only limited by your imagination and what you can actually draw and mm-hmm. those kind of artistic tricks you can pull off. So there's a ton of people making comics now. Mm-hmm. It's such a big deal that now sales numbers, as in total annual sales numbers, are starting to incorporate the crowdfunding numbers, because those crowdfunding numbers, they're just so big, you can't really leave them out because mm-hmm. they make a difference within the industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned that somewhere I read, and I don't know, I haven't seen it but more than once, but that they said that if you put all the Kickstarter stuff together, it would be number two behind Marvel.
Yes. It is a big number. The thing is, it's a hard to measure number. Mm-hmm. I actually got a hold of somebody at Kickstarter and I said, what are your sales? And they said, well, we don't look at them as sales. Mm-hmm. We look at them as completed projects or funded projects. Mm-hmm. So the metrics are different. I mean, we still toil in a medium where success is literally measured in Batman's. Mm-hmm. If you look at the monthly sales figures that come out, mm-hmm. Batman's sales are a one and everything else is a number based on that number.
Well, it's like they always say, Batman is Batman. He looks at everybody else's Robin.
Yes.
And that's kind of how this goes. You know, the Batman comics, and although it's Spider-Man is giving him a run for his money right now. But
I think it's this month. There's 23 Spider-Man books coming out. God. And I used to make fun of people that, mm-hmm. you know, I can be a jackass. But mm-hmm. I said, you know, so your problem is you're a huge Spider-Man fan and you hate that they're super serving you the stuff you really like. Mm-hmm. And it didn't occur to me. But when somebody said, you know, hey, look, smartass, it's 23 books a month times $4. Mm-hmm. We're talking about car payments here. You know, I like Spider-Man, but I don't want to have to read everything just to get the story. I don't want to read, you know, a 12th of a story and say, oh, that was $4 well spent. Yeah. You know, along those lines, that's whenever I'm talking with creators, I tell them, you know, you really need to bring your best work. When I was a kid, you know, there was novels, there was over the air television, there was cable, there was comics. Now, literally everything ever created is at your fingertips. Mm-hmm. So people that are reading my book are not reading Watchmen. They're not watching Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. They're not listening to their favorite music, which they can all stream to handheld devices. Mm-hmm. So when you think about how hard it is to compete for that time, mm-hmm. you really need to up your game and bring your best work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say that Punchline is some of the best stuff out there. Particularly when it comes to superheroes. I mean, I'm a superhero guy. I have always, yeah. you know, we talk about Batman. He's my favorite. I love that stuff. I love his stories and I love things going on with that. But you've always got to end up in the same place where you started.
Yes.
With Batman. Now, see, you don't have to necessarily do that.
We're not selling peanut butter with Punchline stuff so we can wrap stories up or move on to other characters.
Yeah, which is, of course, that makes it more fun to read, to be honest.
If there's anything that's really safe in the world of media, it's being a big name superhero. There were people that complained when Jane Foster became Thor. Always thought that Thor was a dude's name, not a job title.
Right.
But, you know, they were mad about that. It's like, you know, if they just waited 18 months, there'd be a new Thor come along. I mean, there's certain truisms in the world. Clark Kent's always going to be Superman. Bruce Wayne's always going to be Batman. And they may change for a little bit, but it's all going to revert back to your starting position there. Mm-hmm. And the thing about indie books, to an extent, they can be a little dangerous. I mean, if you look at a book like Saga, that mm-hmm. totally has that element of danger to it because those guys own those characters and they can create characters and then they can just mash them like bugs if they feel like.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, that leads me to ask you, what if you do your book and, of course, these two main characters take off? What if another character starts to blossom and people want, well, like, say, Beetle Girl?
Yeah.
Beetle Girl takes off.
The Beetle Girl character, we use the Beetle Girl character as part of a deal with the guy who owns the Beetle Girl character. Mm-hmm. And he licenses her out and she has little adventures with other people from time to time. Mm-hmm. And I actually reached out and I said, you know, hey, we're doing a book where Jesse tries to put together a superhero team and kind of goes sideways. Can I use Beetle Girl again? And he said, yes, please do. And send me some of those books. You know, those books are awesome. But yeah, if we have an Atomic Butterfly story mm-hmm. that does well, if we have a Black Arrow story that does really well, mm-hmm. then, you know, we've got some space at the end of the book. I would be more interested in doing little backup stories than I would spinning something off because Mo production, Mo problems. You know, I've got two sets of deadlines to keep up with, and you know, I can barely keep up with what I've got now. Mm. Especially because I'm an artist too, and I'm inking a chunk of Jungle Comics 2, which is coming up from AP.
Oh wow! Okay, now of course, got to ask now, what's the schedule for Punchline? Is it monthly?
It has been an ongoing monthly. After that second trade comes out, we're going to need to find a way to get back up on top of our schedule.
Okay.
So we may be taking a month or two off, but Matt is very fast. Matt's just kind of stretched a little thin at the moment. Matt and I went half and half on Punchline 9. So I've inked a story with Mel in a typical Mel kind of thing. Mel says, you know, I've made a lot of promises to my sidekick, and that's why she's not on this mission, because I'm going to do something where, you know, I commit a few felonies. And then, you know, things go on from there. But, you know, I've inked part of the book over Gardenio Lima in a story. And then Matthew has a story where Jesse's parents confront her with the possibility that she's a costumed superhero. And she kind of flinches.
God, this book is really good. This deserves to have a huge audience because it's such a good, well put together book. And it's great reading, especially if you're a Long John's fan like I am.
Yeah.
You know, this just really just sings to me. So I really like it. So number six that I got to see, is that already, you said that came out with the trade paperback?
That hit the shelves last Wednesday. So it is the only one that's not sold out. Everything else is sold out at Diamond, or as they say, back ordered.
So number seven, you mentioned you might pull an Image on us and then have a couple of months off, which is perfectly understandable in these days because Image does it and they get away with it. So why not?
Yes. Well, in our case, we have an awkward situation where one of the big draws for the book is Matt and his artwork. And I don't want to run a bunch of fill-in stuff that's within the main continuity of the book. We may do a fill-in title or two. I pitched something, and if that gets picked up, it would be me and somebody else doing some artwork on the book. But no, it's scheduled monthly. We may have some hiccups. We may pull a few all-nighters getting 7, 8, 9, and 10 out on time. But after the trade paperback, after 10 comes out, we will probably either take a month or two off or find some other way to catch up on our deadlines.
Well, again, I say the Image way is what a lot of people do. It gives you a chance to catch up a little bit, get your breath. You were talking about how great the art is and there's a fan following. You shouldn't leave yourself out of that. Your writing is really sparkling in this.
Well, the thing about the way that comics typically work, editors can do portfolio reviews for artists at shows. They can lay out a bunch of pages and look at them and go, yeah, that looks like a car. Yeah, that looks like a fire escape. Yeah, there's two people wearing regular clothes talking. You've got a job. Congrats. You know, with writing, it's a little less obvious and it takes a little bit longer over time to sink in. So I just try not to blow my own horn about how smart I am. Well, I let other people do that.
The books attract people through their art. They keep people through their writing.
Yeah.
That's the way I like to put it. And I think that your writing really is really good. I really, really enjoyed it verbally. I'm going to add this to my pull list because I want to make sure I get them because they're really, really good. And so many things going for it. The great female characters, the fun superheroics, the world building, all these good things, all up to a real great book. Gosh, this could easily be a DC or a Marvel book, in my opinion. It's such a great, great.
Well, that's the thing. I've worked for DC and name drop writing Richie Rich once upon a time. But I had co-written a couple of issues of Robin with my buddy Willingham to help him get back on schedule. And I'd written an issue of Justice League Unlimited, the comic based on the TV show. And I've been one of those knockaround guys who's worked a lot in comics and explored stuff outside of comics from time to time. I'm buddies with Sam De La Rosa, who was he's a local guy. He's a Texas guy. And he had been an inker on those first few Venom books. And he's kind of roaming around doing shows, making a killing on that right now. And when he was obviously out of work for a while, I asked him, I said, Sam, why don't you work for Marvel anymore? And he said, all my editors got fired. And my first thought was, well, that's a stupid reason. And then my one contact at DC got fired. And I was like, oh, Sam wasn't lying. This is a terrible boat to be in.
Yeah.
I did ink some Batman pages in the Batman 66 meets Wonder Woman 77 book from a couple of years ago. And I'm still in touch with that editor, and we're supposed to get together in San Diego if we can. But There's a tremendous bureaucracy at DC, and I would imagine at Marvel too. Mm-hmm. And he's been there a couple of years, and he says, I haven't hired a writer from outside our stable in 2 years. The mm-hmm. 3 years I've been here, I've done it once. And like, you know, so it's tough. You know, once you get in, you're in. But once you're out, you're way out. And you're going to start over.
And I don't want to disparage AC at all because, you know, I'm grateful that they brought your book to reality.
Yeah.
You know, that's, so I want to say kudos to them to bring this book in because it's a wonderful book. But let's just say it deserves a lot more exposure. And there should be a lot more fans picking this book up because it's really, really good. And it's just something special.
Well, thanks. We hope to see some change in our sales based on Free Comic Book Day. Our book got picked out of a couple of solicitations that we sent into Diamond. It was our book, mm-hmm. and it was Fred Perry's Gold Digger book. Not a big fan of that book, but Fred Perry has been doing, he's been writing, penciling, inking, coloring, lettering an issue a month. Mm. For a while, that book's up to like 260. At some point, he's going to break Dave Sims' record. And it's a feat of strength you just can't deny. I was in the meeting where they were figuring out what to send in to Diamond for their Free Comic Book Day pitches. And I stuck up my hand. I said, you got to respect Fred Perry's work ethic. That guy just, he bangs out those stories. I mean, the guy's a pro. Mm-hmm. And then they talked about what to do. And I said, well, somebody asked me, what's your book about? And I said, well, it's about this. We could send in the first one. Second one's a little stabby, mm-hmm. but first one's good. So it got picked, and I think AP shipped 50,000 copies of that Free Comic Book Day book,
wow.
which means there are stores that won't order once they get past Boom or whatever the last big publisher is. They just don't stock that indie stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people seeing our book for the first time, and I hope that makes an impact on the sales.
Well, that's cool. Again, I say to people, you can add this to your list, and they will order it for you. At least they should if they're good. If they're not ordering it for you after you add it to your list, you need another store. But this is such a great book, and if you enjoy superhero stuff like I do, this is a book that you need to be reading. So, Bill, man, I am so happy this is going on. I'm so glad I got to read it because it really is a great book. And
I'm glad you like it.
Oh, I can't wait for more. The bad news is I read issue 6, and now I'm going, I got to get issue 7. I got to make sure I get issue 7.
It may be about 6 weeks before 7 is in your hands. I've got to run a final lettered version of it past Matthew, maybe tonight, maybe sometime this weekend before we head off to a big show in Houston.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, all the best, man. Well, I've got you on the phone. Maybe I should talk about other shows.
There's a Comic Palooza show. I'm not sure when the interview is going to air. I think it's going to air after the show, but that's the Mother's Day weekend. Mm-hmm. After that, I think that Matthew is doing there's a Greater Austin convention in Austin. And that weekend, I'm doing the Celebrity Fan Fest in San Antonio. Mm-hmm. It looks like I will be signing some books at San Diego at the Antarctic Press booth. Mm. I'll be taking some of our crowdfunded books because we printed extras. Mm-hmm. So I'll be selling their comics and our big fabulous trade paperbacks and hardcovers.
Mm-hmm. Were you at Fan Expo Dallas recently?
That was Free Comic Book Day weekend.
Right.
And I thought that I could probably contact the promoter and kind of beat him up for a free table. Mm-hmm. But because in the past, people that love the book so much, we've gotten, you know, hotel and tables covered for a couple of shows. Mm-hmm. And then I thought about it, and I'm like, well, that's kind of against the spirit of what Free Comic Book Day is.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's a day to drive traffic to the stores.
Oh, see, I was there at Fan Expo Dallas, and we were kind of grumbling, why is this on Free Comic Book Day? This is the day when you normally go to stores and stuff like that. So, yeah, you did go to Free Comic Book Day.
There's two big stores in Austin. One of them is Dragon's Lair Austin, which is a huge store. And then there's Austin Books, which is kind of an institution. Mm-hmm. One store, I think Dragon's Lair ordered 500 copies, and Austin Books ordered 1,000.
Wow.
So, you know, we had stacks of books to sign for people at both shops.
Wow. Boy, I hope your subscriptions in those stores will increase exponentially. That would be nice.
I hope so. I think between the two stores, I think I did about 7 hours between the two stores. Like, I signed about 500 copies.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have.
Yep, that's a nice place to be, and I hope it only gets better. I hope you get to sign more and more as time goes along, as well as put out these really good books, because it was a great fun to read. And gosh, I want to see more Punchline. Again, it's Punchline, and it's Antarctic Press, right? I'm going to make sure we get that right. And the first trade and the issue 6 are out, and maybe a little bit before number 7. This makes this the perfect time to put number 7 on your pull list, so that you can keep going from there, and just make sure you get them all from there on. So he goes, Bill, it's a wonderful book. I really loved it. And I'm going to run and put this on my pull list from now on so I don't miss any. Because, man,
that's good.
Such fun. Such a good book. So
thank you very much. It's very kind of you.
Well, I hope you and Matt keep it up because, man, this was a great read.
We're probably also going to be another crowdfunding thing later this summer. But I'd like to have more of the book done before we do a crowdfunding thing. It'd be another punchline thing. Okay, the thing is, getting books in and out of a Chinese printer is a lot more complicated than I thought it was. Yeah, so our first one's shipping a couple of months late.
Yeah, the time. You know, they ship it by boat, don't they? And that makes it harder.
Well, you can ship it by air if you want to spend another $2,000.
Ugh.
Yeah. And in our case, I'm like, well, I don't know if we can afford the $2,000 on air. But, you know, ocean freight goes pretty fast. It turns out it's good for shipping a lot of stuff.
Well, it's worth the wait, even if it takes a little longer, because this was a great book. So you guys keep it up. And, man, I'm going to, as soon as I get to my store this week, the first thing I'm going to do is put this on my pull list.
I sure appreciate it. Thank you very much.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but it's a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
That's it for this week. Please be back next time when I'll be speaking with another great comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.